Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 320 of the podcast. It's Friday, 5th of May, 2017, as I record this, a little early as I'm heading into London this afternoon. Tomorrow, I'm doing a full day seminar on how to make a living and a life with your writing with Orna Ross, and that should be really fun. We've got nearly 50 people, which is definitely enough for one day for me, but I'm excited about that. And today I have an interview with thriller author Dean Crawford on how to make $1 million with your books. But it's not quite the hype you might expect, because the million has been made over a number of years, not in a big spike. So it's definitely something we can all aspire to. So in publishing news this week, I wasn't going to mention it, but it's still going around, is the more fake news about the downfall of ebooks from the Publishers Association, picked up by The Guardian UK, BBC Breakfast and CNN in America. So I just wanted to remind everybody that these publishing studies that say ebooks are dead, people just aren't reading ebooks, they don't measure any books without ISBNs, which are the majority of indie books. And they also don't measure Amazon KU page reads or subscriptions. And they don't measure the borrows that are associated with Prime. They don't there's so many things they don't actually measure. So we have to be very careful. I mean, they don't measure direct sales from websites, which, as I'll talk about in a minute, makes up a percentage of my sales. And the Hot Sheet by industry veterans Porter Anderson and Jane Friedman, which is excellent, comes out every couple of weeks. You can find, just Google The Hot Sheet, Porter Anderson, and you'll find that. Said this week, it's the job of publishers associations to characterize what data they do have on digital sales as only partial, and to be wary of contributing to overstatements of what's known about ebook sales and print supposedly blasting back. Not coming clean about this is misleading to their own customers, as well as to the culture at large. You know, absolutely, they should be admitting that these figures are incomplete, but they don't. And I was pretty annoyed about it. And just, I don't know, every time you think the media might be kind of coming back to some kind of realistic thing, then something like this happens. Also, there was the Hot Sheet reported a report from Reading Pulse, which is a premium industry think tank, saying that e-reading is growing and ebook fatigue is a myth. Publishers are missing a huge opportunity to break out new fiction authors and franchises because they're pricing these titles out of the ebook market. And I definitely see that. Like, I have friends who are traditionally published in the UK, and some of their publishers are putting their books out at more than double the price of an existing bestseller. So, let's say a John Grisham legal thriller might be, $6.99, and a new debut author might be $11.99 in ebook. It's absolutely crazy. It's about $15. they also, this Reading Pulse reported, for the first time in 6 years of tracking, 50% of readers say they've purchased an ebook in the past year, up 6% from 2015, and nearly one out of three readers subscribe to an online ebook subscription service. So that's really interesting. And I was thinking about my own reading habits. I joined KU, Kindle Unlimited, in order to see what the experience was like as a reader. And I definitely find myself borrowing books on KU that I don't necessarily want to own. And then, I know we don't own, we just license, but I buy and pre-order ebooks from authors I know, like, and trust, or if I can't get them another way. So I definitely do both. I subscribe and I buy
Another interesting report from Michael Tamblyn from Kobo, speaking at the Publishers Forum in Berlin, saying that the world of retail is no longer a place in which people ask themselves, where can I buy the next book? But they ask themselves, what do I want to do next? And that may be spending hours binge watching TV or browsing on Facebook or YouTube. And he said, for Kobo, increasingly, this means that we don't wait for consumers to come to us. We have to go where they are already. This is so interesting because this week we noticed this happening, this kind of retailers going where we are. Jonathan, my husband and I, we watch shows on a laptop. We don't have a TV and we watch on Netflix, Amazon Prime and BBC iPlayer, which is a UK, the BBC in the UK. And we started watching a documentary, or what we thought was a documentary, on Netflix called Tales by Light, which profiles a photographer in each episode as they go around the world having adventures, doing exciting things. And I'm obviously a travel junkie, so I wanted to watch it. We also watch a lot of character-based documentaries around food, so Mind of a Chef and Chef's Table and all those different types of ones. So this looked really interesting. And then about three episodes in, Jonathan says, all these cameras are Canon EOS, and there's all these shots of equipment and a discussion of equipment. And there at the end, there was a little tagline, and we Googled it and discovered that the whole series is sponsored by Canon Australia. And this is apparently called native advertising, where essentially you go where the audience is. So in that case, we are Netflix subscribers who like documentaries of beautiful countries and characters, and they've put their camera in front of us but haven't said buy my camera. They've done it in this kind of sideways view. And I thought that this, you know, for authors, this kind of goes back to Austin Kleon's Show Your Work book, which is a great book, and it's basically what I've been doing here on the podcast for years. It's what I've done with my blog, I guess, you know, sharing the author journey. And if you share your journey along the way, rather than saying buy my book, it may be that some of those people might be interested in your book at some point, or not, as the case may be. But it's interesting because we are we at peak ad? I heard from someone who's outside the Facebook industry but is in paid ads. I mean, sorry, outside the author industry, but she has a paid advertising company, that Facebook is reaching peak ads, as in they cannot show all the ads that people want to show, you know, to the people. And they have, what, billion people on Facebook? And, you know, whether we as consumers are getting much more used to ads, and they have to do things at an angle. Now, I absolutely love this show, and we're going to carry on watching Tales by Light, and it's actually been renewed for another season. So presumably they saw great benefit from this. So I'm really encouraged by this show, Tales by Light. If you want to have a look on Netflix, it really is a good show if you enjoy travel and documentaries and photography. So I just want us all to remember that as paid ads become the thing that they have, and absolutely we should all try those. We should also keep in mind sharing our journey, showing our work, bringing people along the way, so that, you know, if they enjoy the things that we do, they might be interested in our books at some point. And this kind of content marketing without being pushy is something that I keep coming back to because it's where I feel most happy. Okay, another interesting thing that I saw in terms of publishing, Forbes reported this week that 66.1% of adults in China used their phones to read in 2016. Now, that's huge. And I think that's interesting because I read on my phone every day. I read the news, I read blogs, I read a lot of books on my phone. And I always listen to the Sell More Book Show every week. And I think Brian listened to this show. So hi, Brian. And it makes me shake my head when Jim Cockerill goes off about how shorter content is the future because of mobile. And I actually totally disagree. I think that I get through huge books on my phone because it doesn't matter how long the book is. It's still the same size screen. It's still the same size page. I kind of agree on shorter chapters because, you know, if I'm in between things, I go through a few pages. But, you know, I was just sitting in the doctor's surgery the other day, nothing important, just a regular thing. And, you know, I read like half a chapter before my before I was called in. And I love reading on my phone. And yeah, I don't think it matters how long the book is, but mobile definitely is a way that I've noticed. You know, I used to read all the time on my Paperwhite, but now I read a lot on my phone. The only time I don't read on my phone is when I'm in bed just before going to sleep, because with the Paperwhite, you can turn, and with many of the Kobo e-reader devices, you can turn down the screen lighting so that it's quite a dark screen, which is better for the nighttime. Okay, so useful stuff this week. I wanted to say it's your last chance to grab the amazing Writer's Story Bundle. You can find it at storybundle.com/writing. It includes Goals and Dreams by Chris Rush, who, as you know, is a mentor of mine, Meeting the Writer's Deadline on Finishing Your Book on Time and Budget, Writing Active Setting, The Crime of Our Lives by Lawrence Block, an online lecture on the Master Plot Formula by Dean Wesley Smith, The Successful Author Mindset by me, and a whole load more books for a pay what you like price. Really great. So go to storybundle.com/writing, and that's available until the 10th of May 2017. Right, so thanks for all your support of the launch of American Demon Hunter's Sacrifice. We did the draws for the launch bonuses, and you will have been notified if you won. And so that's really cool. Thanks to everyone. And just a sort of personal update this week is April marks the end of my financial year for the Creative Pen Limited, which is my company. And I did the breakdown for my book sales revenue and thought these statistics might interest you. I only do this once a year these days. I track my income every month, but I track my income a lot more than every month. I'm not even bothering with book sales figures. So I can't tell you how many books I sold this year. I can just tell you how much, you know, the split was and how much money I made. And, you know, so these figures are all based on revenue rather than actual sales figures. And I will be doing a blog post on it. But just briefly, so my book sales income is overall up 15% on last year. And it is about 3 times the national average salary of a man in Britain. That's as detailed as I'm going to get. Not too bad, considering that I publish pretty slowly compared to many in the market. And 86% of my revenue is from ebooks, 10% from print, and 4% from audio in the last year. So again, that's 90% of my revenue is not tracked by any of the publishing industry surveys. So that'll just give you an idea, because I don't use ISBNs for ebooks or audio still. 48% of my sales are KDP, 14% Kobo, 13% iBooks, 9% CreateSpace, and 9% direct sales this year. So thanks to everyone who buys direct from thecreativepen.com. I have a book page, and every non-fiction book page has a link to buy direct from the website, as well as my audiobooks as well. And I use sells.com, selz.com to do direct sales. Very pleased about that, actually, because obviously if someone buys direct, first of all, I get their email address, but also I get, 95% of the income as opposed to 70% at the other stores. And then 4% Audible, and then some other smaller sites. So in total, with Audible, CreateSpace, and KDP, Amazon is 61% of my income for book sales. It's not of my total income. So I'm encouraged by that, because I know a lot of even traditional publishers would be more dependent on Amazon with that. I'd still like to get it down a bit more. I'd like to grow my sales at the other places because, you know, I don't like being dependent on one company. So 72% of my revenue this year was from fiction, which does make sense, as I have 8 non-fiction, 13 fiction plus 6 fiction box sets. So what's that? 19 fiction products versus 8 non-fiction products. So 72% of my revenue from fiction. That is about the same split of my revenue, fiction, non-fiction on Amazon. But on audio, my sales are only 49% fiction and my non-fiction audio definitely sells more strongly. So this next year, I'm doing more non-fiction audio. On Kobo and iBooks, really interestingly, my non-fiction sales are not even 5%. So I'm speaking to Mark Lefebvre about why that might be. Like, why does non-fiction, you know, not sell as well on Kobo? And I wonder if it's partly to do with the fact that many people who read nonfiction prefer print or like a print book. I know most of my print sales are nonfiction because people like to buy the book and scribble all over it. You know, reference books in general for nonfiction. Also audio, you know, I certainly listen to nonfiction in audio. So I am considering whether to pull my nonfiction from Wide, which is a pretty big deal, but I will give it a chance for a push before going down that route. But this is the second year in a row that my nonfiction sales on iBooks and Kobo have been so small. So I really need to look at what to do going forwards. If you look at the 80-20 rule, I should definitely pull those in, but I'm going to see what I can do to grow that before I make that change. 77% of my fiction income at Kobo was from box sets, fiction box sets. And that's a lot to do with their merchandising options. At Amazon, my box set sales were 44% of revenue, still pretty high, and iBooks 32%. So if you are not doing box sets for your fiction and you have more than 3 books in a series, you are seriously missing out. So yeah, definitely do that. So I hope you found that interesting. Anyway, I wanted to share some of these and I will be blogging about it once I've, you know, had a chance to do that. but I thought it was really, really interesting, that total split. On my writing this week, I'm still focusing on rewriting How to Market a Book, the third edition. I'm trying to get it up as a pre-order as soon as possible because it's going to be a completely new book. I'm not going to overwrite the old book because it is so different. There will still be similar things, but I'm rewriting a lot. You know, the last edition was out in 2014 and things have changed since then. I've changed since then. So yeah, it will be a new book entirely. So even if you own the old one, you'll want this one. I know you will. And I will be trying to get it out in audio at the same time. And also in personal news, I know I'm so spoiled, but I feel very happy that I can do this. This is why I do this. I am off to Venice this week to see Damien Hirst's new show, Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable. And I'm so thrilled about this. I mean, 10 years ago, back in 2006, 2007, when I looked at what I wanted from my life, one of the things was the freedom to be able to go and see things like this and, you know, pop off to Venice. We can go from where I live here in Bath. Bristol Airport is not very far away, just a short hop. You know, it's like an hour and a bit, I think, to Venice. It's really a short journey, just stay for a couple of nights. We're staying on the Lido Island and we'll go and see Damien Hirst's show. He is my very favorite modern artist. I don't think there would be anyone else I would travel for. but yeah, this is going to be amazing. Also Damien Hirst, if you don't know his work, definitely look it up online. He has some stunning things. He's also a bit obsessed with dead stuff. He's got some beautiful things that he's made with insect cases, beautiful colours, and he's a bit into taxidermy, but he also has just gorgeous things. But he's also a very wealthy creative entrepreneur. So look up The Diamond Skull by Damien Hirst. I've seen it, and I've seen it in real life, and it is stunning. Nothing online can do it justice. But I really like him because, one, I love his art, but two, I love him as a businessman. He's more in the model of Picasso than Van Gogh, as in, you know, he's worth a lot of money and he makes great art. So definitely both a creative and a business model for me. Plus, you know, it's Venice in the spring. What can be bad about that? So I will probably write a short story. I'll definitely blog about it. And the pictures will be on Twitter @thecreativepen. and Instagram, JF Penn Author. And I will also post on Facebook, facebook.com/JF Penn Author. When I do these kind of things that feed into my fiction, I tend to post on my fiction social media. So yes, I am super lucky. I'm very grateful this week for the life I'm able to lead. And thank you to everyone who supports the show and buys my books. And I hope that it inspires you to be able to aim for a life that you want to live. All right, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Tanya says, I've been binge listening to your podcast and been blown away by how much I've learned. Thank you, Tanya. I'm always impressed by you binge listeners. I'm very much at the start of my writing career, so I just want to learn everything. She also says, you always seem to have listeners that are swimming with dolphins or skydiving or somewhere exciting. I'm usually cleaning my 2-year-old's wee off the floor or hanging baskets of washing on the line. So yes, thank you to everyone who listens while doing their household chores. I mean, I listen to podcasts whilst doing chores, so that's completely normal. Jenny says, I love the show, never miss an episode. During a recent hospital stay, I listened to your voice. Listening to your voice through my earbuds felt like being visited by a friend. Oh, thank you, Jenny, and get well soon. And, you know, I really appreciate that. Anna McNuff, the adventurer, sent a picture in the snow and said, wild hair deserves a wild backdrop, which is very cool. Springtime snow. Michael, oh yeah, this is funny. He said, I always learn something new. Last podcast, you revealed a big surprise that you thought you were sick, but as your partner said, it turned out you were simply very tired. I had no idea you are ever tired. In fact, I have no idea how you get everything done. so I do get tired, and I do need to manage my energy better. It's something I'm not very good at. So thank you, Michael. And yes, I'm completely normal, but I do choose to curate my energy for you guys. So I always record this introduction in the morning so that you can get the benefit of my energy. I would not record this intro late in the evening when my energy is low or after I've done a whole load of other things during the day. So it's very important to me to bring my energy to you guys every week because I know that writing can be hard and I hope that I can help you get through to another Monday. Timothy Trimble, the nice thing about spending 2 hours mowing a half acre of grass is I get to listen to the show. Thanks to Ashley, who sent me pictures of Belize Yarborough Cemetery in Belize City, which is lovely. And finally, thanks to Janita, who sent me a lovely email, which made my day about the podcast, really helping her on the journey. And your enthusiasm and pragmatism have made me believe for the first time I could make a living from my writing. And I really love to hear that when I've helped people because you can. And those of you who do binge listen to the show, what you've got to remember is back in 2009 when I started podcasting, I was still working at the day job and it was 2 more years before I left my day job after I started this show. 2.5 years, I guess. I started the show in March 2009 and I left my job in September 2011. So, you know, it's crazy how much things can change over time if you just consistently put stuff out there, if you work on your craft and your production process and you do a little bit of marketing. You know, you don't need to get too het up with everything. Just aim for the life that you want. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from our sponsor in a minute. But again, because Kobo sponsored the show, I'll just remind you that box sets do really well on Kobo and have great merchandising, and 14% of my book sales income comes from Kobo, so I definitely appreciate that. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks also to new patrons, Libby Cutts, Bonnie Lacey, Max Smith, Nate Hofelder from the great site, The Digital Reader. And Nate also does WordPress help and blog help and is helping me at the moment. So thank you, Nate. Deborah Clopton, Don King, Diana Wink, and JT Lawrence. So thank you, everyone. I really do appreciate the Patreon support. Like the tweets and emails, it really demonstrates that you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And if you would like to support the show with just a couple of dollars, coffee or two a month, you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. And remember, you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which is 30 to 45 minutes of me answering questions from Patreon supporters about all kinds of things. So it's that little little extra behind the scenes. So if you enjoy the intro to the show, you'll definitely enjoy that extra monthly audio. So again, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, let's get on with the interview.
Hello, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Author Relations at Kobo. A lot of authors often ask me, what are our merchandisers looking for? What kind of books are featured on Kobo, and how can I get my books featured on Kobo? Well, this is information that can actually help not just with Kobo, but with some of the other places that are more interested in doing human-based merchandising. So Kobo, Nook, and iBooks are probably more in line with doing this type of promo. And what they're really looking for is professionalism, looking for a fantastic cover that speaks to your target audience. Clean metadata is critical. Putting the right information in the right fields like title, subtitle, particularly volume number, if you're writing books in a series, that helps us help get those in front of the right customers. And a decent price point, which means doing global pricing, ending your prices in most English language territories with a .99 price, or in European or in pounds at 0.49 or .99, and actually thinking about different pricing in different countries. For example, in India, you have to price bargain basement low to get any attention. In the UK, the publishers are very competitive, so you got to keep your prices low there. But in places like Canada or Australia, New Zealand, the tolerance for a slightly higher price is okay, and you can actually walk your price up just a little bit more without hurting your bottom line sales while still giving your readers a good value. You can find more tips like this at KoboWritingLife.com, where you can also click on and publish directly to Kobo through the Kobo Writing Life portal. But let's get back to your host, Joanna Penn, with the Creative Pen Podcast.
Today, I'm here with Dean Crawford. Hi, Dean.
Hello.
Hello. It's good to have you back on the show. Just a little introduction. Dean is the international best-selling author of the Warner and Lopez action-adventure thriller series, as well as the sci-fi Atlantia series and other standalone novels. Dean has been on the show before, back in October 2015, when he talked about his move from traditional publishing to indie. And today we're talking about his new non-fiction book called Blockbuster, How to Write $1 Million by an author who's actually done it, which I think is awesome. So I just had to talk to you about this, Dean. So, you know, congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's a hell of a milestone.
So let's just, before we talk a bit more in detail about the money, just, you know, for people who didn't hear our last interview, just tell us a bit more about the your emotional journey, your emotional arc, which you do have in the book, which is awesome, of, you know, obviously the money is not everything. What, you know, from your wanting to write a book to traditional to indie, just give us a quick overview of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long, it's 15 years from me sitting down wanting to perhaps start trying to make a career for myself as an author to actually getting my first deal. I started in 1994, I think it was. My first deal was September 2010, and that was with Simon & Schuster. Ultimately became for five books. They ran pretty well. And then during that process, independent publishing became a thing. And I'd sort of realised about the same time that publishing is a business and writing a book is the art. Publishing a book and selling it is a business. And I saw indie as an opportunity to give myself more than one avenue for revenue for my books and make sure that I wasn't utterly dependent on a publisher. And I followed that, unusually for most people at my stage of a career at that time. and it kind of paid off, and I'm now more indie than I am traditionally published, and enjoying it more as well. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I wanted to just point that out to people. Yeah, it took you 15 years to go from wanting to write to getting that first deal. And obviously that was in 2010. We're now in 2017. So your arc from getting that first deal to now being very successful indie is quite short, actually. There's a lot of people who have been going a lot longer. But let's just talk about that million, because a lot of people have like, oh, $1 million. Like, is that from one of those movies, Austin Powers?
Austin Powers, yeah.
Million. But that is a number that is kind of sexy to a lot of people. So I get why you put it in the title. But obviously, if it was a million since 1994, that's actually not such a...
Not great.
It's not great at all, is it? So can we just break that down? Like, how many books do you have? How much time did that take? What's the split between traditional publishing and indie publishing? Just kind of break that down a bit more.
The $1 million is everything I've earned between September 2010, which was the start of the traditional publishing deals, all the way to November 2016, which is when I was actually writing Blockbuster. And it's broken down. I did do the math. It was 2/3 with traditional. Mm-hmm. And since July 2013, the other third is my indie books. So about $650,000 from the American publishers. And the other 350, all from my own indie books under my Fictum label.
Which is awesome. And I really appreciate you breaking that down. And 2/3 of that traditional is really interesting. So how many books were there in total?
With Simon & Schuster, it was 5 books traditionally published. And the other 15 are on my label. They're the indie books.
Yeah, and that's really...
So 20 in total at the moment.
Yeah. So, and I also want to, I mean, we need to point out that back in 2010, people were getting big advances, right? So do you think that you hit a zeitgeist that, you know, with your action adventure thrillers that is not really available anymore to new debut authors?
Yeah, absolutely. My agent actually once told me, he said I was the last of the big signings for that kind of genre at that time. There's been a couple since. I think some elements of action adventure, the Dan Brown kind of thing, pick up every time. Well, pretty much every time Dan Brown releases a novel in some cases. But as a genre, it's a lot lower now than it was 5-10 years ago when it was at its height. If you're looking at writing an action adventure novel now, you're almost certainly better off going indie with it.
Yeah, which is really interesting. So talk a bit more then about the 1/3 indie has been since 2013.
Yeah.
And you said that you're happier now and you're enjoying it. So, but some people are going to go, but it's only 1/3 of the money, Dean. Just in a financial sense, why, or an emotional, I guess, why are you happier being indie?
Well, with traditional publishers, you've got to write what the market, or they perceive the market, wants. It's not enough anymore to just write a good novel. They're becoming increasingly polarized, really, and dependent on what people are buying in bookshops. And what people are buying in bookshops doesn't reflect what readers are buying in general. With indie publishing, you can just write what you want and also what you're good at. The big stuff selling for traditional publishers now is very much the Gone Girl mold, still is, has been for some years now. Mm-hmm. Girl on a train, girl goes up, girl goes down, girl goes round and round. You know, it's all the same. It's very much linear, and they're waiting probably in the publishers for the next new thing to come along, which might be Amazonian warrior ninja wars in Brazil or something. Who knows? And I'm not particularly good at the Gone Girl type stuff. It's just not what I do. I did try writing one for my agent. They liked it, but I just had no passion for it. Mm-hmm. Whereas with indie, I can just focus on what I want. I can write what I'm good at. And there is always an audience for it. Whereas traditional publishers, it's very much a gatekeeper model. We're looking for X. We're only interested in authors that are going to deliver X. And they'll just follow each other's lead. And the same thing happened many years ago with J.K. Rowling and children's books. You know, she did Harry Potter, had a hell of a time trying to sell it. It took over a year. Eventually sold it to a small American publisher called... Bloomsbury, I think they were called, was it?
It was Little Brown, who were part of Bloomsbury, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it took off in America and suddenly everybody wanted children's books, and that's very much the mould they follow.
Yeah.
So most traditional authors are kind of waiting for their genre to come around all the time, and I come back to them as things going in and out of fashion.
Yeah, and of course, I think you know this, but I target you with my Amazon ads.
As well as, I kept seeing them, yeah.
Yeah, as well as Dan Brown. And it's funny because, of course, this is a Dan Brown year, right? I presume you're excited about his new book coming out.
Origin
in October. Yeah.
I've seen it. I've not heard much about it, but I have seen it.
They're keeping it under wraps, but yeah, good year for you and me.
Yeah, it's a good thing. We can always ride the back off of Dan Brown. You know, he's very generous of him to release a book for us this year. I appreciate it.
I wish he'd hurry up and like do more and build a bigger market. But.
Get on with it. He only does about one every 4 years now.
So. Exactly, yeah. But just coming back on the, you know, you talked about the Gone Girl kind of phenomenon. What was interesting at London Book Fair this year is that a lot of the talk was they want something new, like the psychological thriller is gone. And I've been hearing in the Facebook groups and stuff, like authors are scared because they've built their careers on the psychological thriller. So just kind of, you know, jumping around a bit, do you think that there's going to be a number of traditionally published authors off, you know, once this has dipped, this psychological thriller genre dips, are they going to be looking at indie to write the same stuff? Or do you think there's such an entrenched opinion of self-publishing that they won't do that?
I think it's changed a lot since we last spoke in 2015. I think the authors are now aware that it's not just, you know, indie publishing is not this kind of second best alternative that you take because you couldn't get a deal. I think a lot more of them now are actually looking at it as a first move. And if I get emails and Facebook messages all the time from authors launching a first book or a third book, what do you think I should do with it? And you know, while I'm not a lawyer of publishing sort of thing, I often say, well, based on your genre, if you're an action adventure author, go indie. These guys and girls that have been writing the Gone Girl vein type of book for so many years now, I mean, they're going to get dropped like hot cakes. I mean, that's just hot rocks. That's just what happens. Publishers move on. You're their favourite when you're selling well, and then they've forgotten your number by the time you're not selling well again, you know. So, yeah, there could be a pretty big influx. But the trouble is, what do they do with it? People, authors who have been used to being published by publishers don't have the skills. They can write the book, but they can't make it move. They're going to have to start learning pretty much from the bottom and work their way up. So, I think it will affect that genre, but it'll take them a couple of years to catch up, I reckon.
Right. And that's interesting. So you mentioned about genre there, and you have a lot about it in the book. A lot of newer authors don't even know what their genre is. Like, it's often one of the first things that people have to sort out is what the hell am I actually writing? So what do you say to people? Like you say, people email you and things. How do you get people to recognize the genre they're writing in?
Look at your own bookshelves. Look at your what excites you when you walk into a bookshop and you're looking for your next read. You know what you like, and you look at the bookshelves, and then probably, hopefully, you'll find one. You think, that's it. I've got to read it. I've got to read it. I can't walk out of this bookstore without buying that book. That's probably the books that you're going to want to write the most, and that's probably going to be your genre. It does vary. People find, as I did, I started writing action adventure more on the Wilbur Smith historical side. Mm. And then found out I kind of more like thrillers. But I had both on my bookshelves, and sometimes, as I think you once said recently, it takes you two or three books to kind of really find your voice and what you really love. But yeah, the good starting point is what you read the most, very definitely, and then you're going to want to try and emulate that, and through emulation you develop your own voice. So it's a good place to start, as your very own bookshelf.
Mm. And why did you move into writing science fiction?
Because I loved it. I always loved Star Wars, Star Trek, but I didn't think I had the imagination to do it. So I stayed with more real world stuff mixed with a bit of what you think about it. Some of the books I wrote, the action adventure, they've got that paranormal edge to them sometimes. It's kind of science fiction-y. I had elements in there, and then as I grew more confident and had my own ideas and things that I wanted to do, then I thought, now's the time. Now I can go and do something on that front. And it's also a market, thinking business, that had suffered when indie publishing came along for traditional publishers. The sci-fi market just dropped, the bottom dropped out of it. Whereas indie authors are doing great.
Mm.
Looking to publish to my own label, what genre do I go for? Oh, science fiction is doing really great. So it was also a business decision as well as a creative one.
Mm. Oh, that's good, because I think that's important, is actually looking at, you know, the combination of the writing into a market that works, but also writing something that you love. I mean, you're not writing anything just to market, are you? You're writing what you love first.
Yeah, but the only time I tried to write to market was that one book, the Gone Girly type style thing, for my agent, because he said that's what they were pushing, that's what they were looking for. And it was a perfectly competent book. And I've since self-published it, and it's done really well. It's done all right. But the publishers were like, no, it's just not quite right. It's not this, it's not that. And I looked and I thought, it is. It's all right, you know. And I went ahead and self-published it in the end, and it did just fine. So, you know, you can't. They have their own idea of their PR departments, and they pretty much decide what gets bought. It's not even down to an editor anymore. PR department says, what are we selling best? Oh, that's what we want. Does this new guys or girls book fit what we're selling? And authors often get rejected and they think the book's no good, and it's nothing to do with it. It's just often the market and what these PR departments feel the publishers spend their money on. A lot of the time it's just throwing stuff at a wall to see what will stick, you know. They have no idea what's going to work. They just don't.
Well, I mean, this is what's so interesting, of course, is no one has any idea. And even just this podcast, I now just interview people. I always have done. I just interview people I'm interested in and stuff. I talk about things I'm interested in. And I don't even try to like hit any kind of zeitgeist. And I'm always surprised at what people enjoy about the show. And you just never know what people will like, do you? And also things change over time. You just can't, if everyone could predict a blockbuster, you know, there would be a lot more blockbusters.
It's exactly right. It's the first three pages of my book tells people who are going to buy a blockbuster what it won't do. It will not guarantee them a blockbuster. It will not write the book for them. It won't do this, that, and that's what a lot of these kind of books promise. So I'll do this, it'll work, you know. And I tell them, I say, it won't do that. But what it can do is shave 14 of the 15 years off it took me to get it right, you know. It's kind of what it's about. It's you know, how to write a book competently. You can't say how to write a good book, because everyone's idea is different, but it says this is how I go about it. If you copy this, you will come up hopefully with a competent book, and then this is how you can then sell it to a publisher if you want to go that route, or independently.
And for those of you on the audio, Dean was shaking his head at the traditional publishing option. So let's talk about writing that competent book, which I think is a good way of putting it. One of the things that you talk about is writing a hook that will grab the reader. And I think this is something that is pretty difficult, again, especially when you're first starting out writing. You often have ideas that are not the hook at the beginning, and you kind of have to think about the hook later. So what are some good ways for people to come up with hooks? What's the line between originality and genre expectation for a hook?
I mean, the way I started was really just to look at things that had all been done. You're not copying, you're just kind of looking for inspiration. So a strong hook for an idea, one author that's recently made a name for himself, Adam Croft, and it's one I actually quote in the book. You're welcome, Adam. Her Last Tomorrow, and the hook line was, it's every parent's worst nightmare, so-and-so's daughter has been kidnapped, and you can have the daughter back as long as he murders his wife. That is the hook, in as many words, or sort of paraphrasing it from memory. And that's a hook, because you instantly think, oh, how's he going to pull that off? You know, obviously he's not going to murder his wife, but how's he going to do it? And you're trying to look for things that are like that, that instantly grab attention and make you think how. And movie posters are a great place to look. They often only have a couple of lines in order to hook an audience, and they'll come up with great things that you can look at and say, well, that's a hook. That's a high concept idea, they call it in Hollywood. And many films, many books are all built around a question or something like that. And the best place to look for it is in the news. Like I say, look at things that would have been done, look at movie posters, and think, well, what can I come up with that is similar to that, but obviously it's my own idea. And then if you're writing in a similar genre, then in many ways genre is the fuel for the idea. If you're writing, as Joe and I are doing, in action adventure, then it's often a MacGuffin. It's the Indiana Jones model. What are they chasing? Is it the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, Atlantis, whatever it might be? And they found it, and that's your cover, and that's your hook line. of course, you're not going to tell the reader how they've done it. You're going to add that in. That's the story, is how they got to that point. So it's not easy to come up with a new hook, something completely new. And there probably are no new hooks under the sun. It's more variations on a theme. But they are essential. If you haven't got the reader by the cover and the first page, you haven't got the reader. Kind of the rule I've set for myself.
Yeah, and I think that's so important. But also it has to be something that we're interested in. So you mentioned the Ark of the Covenant, which is great. And when I wrote Ark of Blood, you know, and everyone, I think it's like when if you're writing an action adventure thriller in the Dan Brown kind of niche, you have to write your Ark of the Covenant book at some point. It just is. And I, at the time I thought, oh no, I can't do this because it's been done before. And then it's like, yeah, there's a point that it's been done before because it's a mystery, because we don't have the Ark of the Covenant. So we will never be able to come up with an answer to that, you know, until one of us finds it, obviously. But I think that those genre conventions are so important. Like, obviously, romance, if you're going to have a happy ending, a happy ever after, an HEA, well, we know the ending. It's how do you get there? So I think that's really important. So, I mean, how do you know that a hook is good enough? Do you come up with a whole load of them and then choose one, or how do you do that?
I'm writing them down all the time. I mean, it's hardly a day goes by when I don't sort of dream something up. And most of them are rubbish, I find. But every sort of five or six of them, I write it down, I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, there's something there. You just know. In the same way, going back to the bookshelves and that, when you see that book you've got to read, or you see the post of the film you've got to see, when you think up one of your own, you just get a tingle. Like a really good song you haven't heard before, and it's, you know, you hear the first bars and the hairs go up in your neck, and you say, I'm going to like this one. That's your idea. That's the one that's going to work. Because if it excites you, it's probably going to excite your readers, because we're all readers as well. So, there's just a feeling you get. And when I come up with it, I mean, sometimes I can't stop making notes for hours. It just fires the imagination, bang them off, you know, and annoys the hell out of my family because, you know, or shut. Oh, I know, you know, I'm busy. but some of the best ideas come from those things. So it's just a case of working at it all the time. Write everything down. I say that a lot in the book. Buy a notepad, buy a pen, keep it on you all times, because you'll be amazed that, you know, when these ideas arrive, you'll see something and it just clicks.
And you write a lot about science and, you know, scientific things and, you know, that type of thing. Do you like read a lot of journals or go to exhibitions, or like, how do you feed your brain for ideas?
Everything really. The internet, I'm a subscriber to, I haven't got a copy here at the moment, Focus Magazine, which is a British science, all the fun bits of science, none of the boring stuff, you know. And that's monthly, and that comes out, and invariably every edition of that has got something in there that I look at and I go, wow, you know, I'll jot that down for a future Warner and Lopez book or something like that. And I've discovered probably a third of my ideas just from that one magazine. So it's not like you have to read science journals or anything like that, or go into in-depth research. That tends to come later when you've already found that hook and that story you want to write, and then you start digging into it, and then it starts getting a little bit heavy sometimes on the research. But and then, of course, you can't waffle about it. You've got to filter out the interesting bits, and because you don't want to write a physics manual, you want to write an action adventure novel. So, it's everywhere. Watch the news. Make effort watching the news every night. Read a book a month. You know, set yourself goals that put you in inspiration's way, rather than waiting for inspiration to come to you. That's probably the best way to describe it. You just got to keep looking all the time.
I actually think the physical magazine is, I found myself using them more and more. Like, you know, if you go into WH Smith's, which is one of our British, you know, high street shops for Americans, you can see like maybe 200 magazines. So like if you wanted to write a character about a knitter, and I'm not a knitter, you can find knitting magazines, or like a fisherman, and, you know, like you're saying, like science and all those things. I think, like you're saying, you can shortcut research by finding them out through someone who's already curated, and then you can go deeper. I think that's awesome, because the internet can be a bit big sometimes, can't it?
And untrustworthy, yeah. It's you have to sort of, if you're using the internet, I do use it a lot. I think everyone does, and Wikipedia especially is good. But I've got the habit now of looking for a second source to verify the first one and things like that, because yeah, you can go down the wrong rabbit hole there and find information that's not true. I love that meme that was doing the rounds on Facebook a while ago. It said, not everything on the internet is true. And it had William Franklin or something else from 1846, you know, and stuff like that, where it's obviously a falsehood in itself. Yeah, always check your sources, basically.
Yeah. Okay, so obviously writing a good book is, competent book, good is in the eye of the reader, in the brain of the reader, whatever. So what is working for you right now in terms of marketing? Like, what are the things that you say have to happen in order to market the book?
It's a big subject, really. Everything. I would say the most important thing in terms of marketing isn't something that you buy or, you know, it's not AMS adverts or Facebook, it's brand. It's, especially in terms of series, making the books look very clearly that they're a part of the same family all the time. Even myself, who write in two different genres, they still have an appearance. So you could look at it, so that's a Dean Crawford book. You just know by the way I lay them out on the covers. And that's the most important bit of marketing I think you can do. Backing it up, Amazon ads are the business. I like Amazon. Really. They get it right. They always do. And it maybe takes some time sometimes, but they get there. And I'm finding them to be the most useful. But they're only in America. Mm. So Facebook ads is something I direct at the UK only and Australia and places like that. And they're still the daddies. BookBub, well, I know for a fact now that the publishers are buying BookBub slots way, way in advance. We're not allowed to do that. Mm. There's something going on there. It's getting harder to get a BookBub placement unless it's kind of a box set or something like that. So, yeah, really, the Facebook model that Mark Dawson and others have done their courses for, which are very, very good, well worth taking if you've got a few books behind you. Not so much if you've only gone your first book, because it's very difficult to market a first book without a lead on for the audience to carry on to. And Amazon ads for anything and everything almost are pretty damn good at the moment. So that's what's working for me. Amazon ads is top of the draw at the moment.
Oh, okay. So basically having I just got to come back on your covers. Do you still do your own covers?
All of them.
Which is just crazy. Why do you still do your own covers?
Yeah, because I can. I see some great covers out there by dedicated artists. And they're probably better than mine. They are better than mine in some cases, but I can do it. I have the skills, and it just seems, why would I bother paying somebody $400 for a cover that I can do myself anyway?
And do you enjoy that?
Yeah, I love it. It's a break from writing. You know, I've just finished doing a touch typing course. So I'm just kind of, you know, like my wife says, I'm like a robot sitting there, my fingers are moving, nothing else, you know? And after a while, because it's new to me at the moment, it changes which muscles ache and that, you know. And so it's great to just get the mouse out and do the next cover. I've just done my next book cover, spent a couple of hours on it last night, you know, and I enjoy it. It's a break. It's different. And I always ask my readers, are these any good? I go on my Facebook page, a fan page, and say, I'll put it up there and say, what do you think, you know? And they're all coming back saying, yeah, love it. So I guess I'm doing it right.
Yeah, I just find that interesting because, I did my own cover years and years ago and it was terrible. So it's great if you enjoy it and they're good enough. But it's interesting there, you talked about learning to touch type. That's awesome. How have you just been henpecking for years?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I'm just putting my keyboard underneath it. I did touch type in a sense, but I kept looking at the keys and I'm moving my hands all over the keyboard. And I got up to about 2,000 words an hour quite reliably doing that, which is why I can release books so quickly. It's mostly just the speed of typing. But typo slipping, things aren't as good. It's better to look at the screen. So basically what I did, it's an online course. It's free. You can find them anywhere on Google. And I did that so that I could sit in a more relaxed position. I'm not doing this, moving my arms. I'm kind of like that. And build up the speed. And it's taken about a month. But I'm now at about 1,500 words an hour, and it's much better because you can just watch the screen, and every time you see a typo, just quickly backtrack and get rid of it. So you're getting a much cleaner draft with each chapter, and it doesn't hurt the shoulders as much. So I found it's one of the best things I've ever done. It's well worth doing.
How and interesting.
You have to be strict, though. You have to get one of the pillow covers and put it over my hand so I can't see the keyboard or I'll even type with my eyes closed. Because it's so easy to look down and you can't do it. So I've been doing that for, about a month now. And I've actually taken, I don't use the cover anymore because I've stopped looking at the keyboard.
So did you consider dictation or any other way to
tried.
Didn't work?
Well, it worked brilliantly. But the trouble is, it's very good. You have to train like Dragon, most people use. And I've got Dragon 13 or whatever it is. And I wrote a whole novel with it. And I'm sitting there chatting away to myself. It's very weird to start with. But I was getting like 8,000 words a day, which is a real good turnout. But the computer program couldn't differentiate between there, and there.
So you had to do a lot of editing.
A lot of editing. And I found that it cost as much time as it gained in the long run. And there were more mistakes slipping through afterward as well. You know, readers coming back saying, oh, you've done this wrong or whatever. Especially when you've got strange names, Russian names of the enemy, as it were, and everything in there. So I abandoned that. And the other reason that I've done this is because I'm starting to move into the age of marketing where I'm not going to release as many books as quickly as I have done up to now and really start focusing on getting those books in front of the right people. But I want to maintain the pace. And so, the touch typing course enables me to type faster and more accurately in the long run, meaning I can spend more time selling my books to people who I'm sure just want to get hold of them.
Well, I think that's awesome. And I hope people listening are kind of noting this because you started writing in 1994 and you've learned some skills along the way about writing craft. And now you're doing a touch typing course, which I think is so awesome. So do you think this constant learning is one of the most important things about being an indie or just making a living this way?
It's vital on all fronts. It's why I didn't have a definitive answer for what was working for marketing, really, because everything counts. You can't not be constantly with your ear to the ground. You've got to be aware of what marketing works, what other authors are doing, what kind of books are selling the best, what cover designs are working, because even things like that change over time and the kind of things that readers automatically sort of drift towards. So you look at some of these Gone Girl covers that we were talking about before and the books like it, they all look the same.
Oh, they do, yeah.
They all look the same because people want to see that, that kind of read those sort of books. And so you've got to be on touch with everything and it is a full-time job. It doesn't matter how successful you get. You know, it's probably very easy for people coming in now to start with looking at the guys and girls at the top and saying, oh, must be wonderful. I bet they write one book a year. And you look at them, people like Jerry Riddle, Russell Blake, Hugh Howey, all these people, and they're always advertising. You can always see their books being, they're always doing something. They're running blog tours. They're, you know, they're never sitting still, basically. And that applies to all, I think, genres and authors, but especially the indies, because we do it all ourselves. So, yeah, you can't afford to be kind of taking it easy, I think.
Well, but you've said that you're going to write at potentially a slower pace, but move into this age of marketing. So what else are you looking at? So you've got Amazon ads and Facebook ads. You know, what else are you going to be focusing on that might be, interesting to the listeners?
Well, it's more a case of just getting the books that I've got already out there. I mean, I've sort of become an outlier now myself. Again, you know, I've done it with traditional publishing. Now I've done it with indie publishing. But I haven't even touched 0.01% of the market that's out there. And I very much look up to authors, some of the ones that I mentioned, like Jerry Riddle and that, who have written books and kept them consistently in the top 100 for years. And that shows how big that market is out there because all these people are just discovering these authors. People like Lee Child, the Jack Reacher author, who has done very well over his career. And he himself said he's probably completely stranger to 70% of all readers out there. And so it's more a case of taking what I've already got and using Facebook, AMS adverts, trying to run more promotions. I'm so useless at running promotions. I hardly ever do it because I'm so busy all the time. There's always something else to be doing. And really just making an effort to market the lead titles in each of my series. So I'd be the first in series of each one. And just going mental on the marketing. I was supposed to be doing this last year. That was when I was going to start. This time last year. And then I had a massive hit. I had my first ever top 100 at full price. And I suddenly realized, oh, I've got to focus on that series for a bit. You know, I've got to keep that moving. And so now it's like, okay, now I'm in a position, I've got whatever it is, 20 indie books behind me, really start getting these out in front of readers.
Mm.
And there's nothing special about it. I can't sit here and say, oh, I'm going to be doing some unique and amazing thing to do it. It's not. It's just nose to the grindstone like every other author out there, and running more promotions, Kindle Nation Daily, eReady News Today, BookBub, if I can get them, if the, you know, the sun's in the right position and the wind's following, and you know, all these kind of things, and just doing everything, just like we're saying, doing everything all the time, and building a mailing list, all the usuals, you know, and just more of it.
So that doesn't give anyone any silver bullets. So everyone's like, yeah, we've heard all that before. But what is interesting then, how do you prevent burnout from all the things that you're doing? Like you said, you're so busy, and, you know, what do you love about this? What are you excited about? And what is kind of a bit of a grind as an indie?
Well, I generally stop burnout using Valium. The hardest thing for me is sitting still. I'm not a sit still person. I'm an up and about person. So that's the toughest thing about writing books. Burnout. Yeah, I've started to feel like I'm getting a bit fed up with writing so many books. I can say that honestly. Mm. There's only so many, even though I'm a quick writer and I don't find it hard to bring out a book every 12 weeks or so, I just want to do new things. So it's not a silver bullet. I'm starting a new series as of the release of my next book, which is called the Power Read series, and I'm actually doing novellas. I've got about a dozen standalone ideas that I can't shoehorn into a series and don't warrant a series of their own.
Mm.
I've got them sitting there, all these ideas, and I don't know what to do with them, and I couldn't find a way of turning them into revenue except to target the commuting reader. Who wants a shorter read? They're reading on their phone, stuff like that. And I thought, well, what about doing shorter reads, making all these ideas into new books and releasing a book a month? Bang, 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 bang. So I've got them already lined up, by the way. I've already done this, so don't try and cheat me to it. The books are all lined up for the summer, and I'm just going to be releasing one month after month, very low price, but not the 99 cents price. And that's been my idea to try and reach a new audience and broaden my reach, and also keep the books a length that I can still write at high pace. But the rest of it, you say about silver bullet, there isn't one.
Yeah,
there just isn't. Even the guys and girls who got lucky with there was people that were doing serials back in the day. Hugh Howey, you just took off with Wall Serial, and that you can't do that anymore. Really, there's no silver bullet. Things come along, Facebook advertising. Made Mark Dawson's career, you know, he was doing all right before, but that really sent him sky high. He's now monetized that, and everyone's doing it. So it's not a silver bullet anymore. I think the only silver bullet is to realize something's going to be a winner very early on. So anybody who took on Amazon ads really early has probably found it to be a winner. But for most of us, there's no silver bullet except effort and hard work all the time. I mean, I'm probably sounding a bit like a stuck record really myself. You know, it's hard work, but that's just what it is. You just got to keep doing that. There is nothing I can say in a podcast or an interview that is, do this and it'll work.
Mm.
There isn't.
Didn't it? Well, I know you're, I hope people realise you're quite a chilled out type of guy, as in, you know, you're not going to be like rah rah American about things. But what are you still enjoying? I mean, obviously, what's nice there is you're talking about writing as the marketing. You're writing novellas as the marketing. So, what are you enjoying that best about being an indie? Like you said at the beginning, the being able to write what you want, is that still what is keeping you in this game?
Yes, it's still the two chief things are the fact that I can write what I want and make these sudden decisions and decide I'm going to change tack for a few months. And the second thing is that it's so much fairer in terms of what an author can earn. Traditional publishing, I'm the outlier there as well. I've got the big advances. Most authors get maybe a few £1,000 if they're lucky for three books, spread over 3 years. You know, it's nothing. They can't give up their day jobs. And then they get nothing in terms of royalties from it. A book that's published for a traditional publisher now has about 2 weeks shelf life. It doesn't run. It's gone. And apparently, so I hear, I think it's 75% of all published books are pulped. I think it's something like that.
Print books, yeah.
Yeah. So as obviously those 75% of published books, nobody's going to be earning any money from them, publishers or authors, you know. Whereas independent publishing, you don't need to sell a lot of books to make a really great living. I know I've said this before on the podcast and other places, and that's really what keeps me in. That's what keeps me going, because it's so much fairer. The author has a chance of making a living and doing quite well out of it. People think, oh, I sell a lot of books, but really, on the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot. You know, I've got a lot of books all selling moderately. You've only got to go and look at my ranks on Amazon. You know, I've got nothing in the top 5,000, I don't think, at the moment. But yet, you know, doing very, very well out of it. You know, last year was a six-figure year for me in pounds as well. So, I mean, it's an incredible position to be in. And that is probably above everything else, the one thing, even for authors just coming into the game, that is the one advantage. You don't need to sell a lot of books to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Whereas with publishing, you've got to sell a lot of books to even get anywhere. You know, it's so much harder.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I mean, I say this to people too. It's like, you know, I have, what, 23 books or something now as well, and I, my ranking same as yours, well, you're higher with your fiction, but you know, across the board, you don't have to make loads of money per book if you have lots of books. So probably the biggest piece of advice is get to 20 books. And I think once you have 20 books, which may sound really big to some people, but hey, what else do you want to do with your spare time? But once you get to 20 books, I mean, I think this is pretty reliable that once you have 20 books, I know a lot of people who have six figures at 20 books. So it's, you know, and I mean, let's face it, we don't all need to make the million in a year, right? We, like you've done, it's making it over a number of years and having a sustainable income for you and your family. You've got a daughter, haven't you? So you're, you know, it's not just you in one room.
No, that's right. You've hit the nail on the head, really. It's about people who are paying the mortgage that couldn't before from their writing, or, you know, sending their kids to college or whatever it might be. There's so many authors out there able to do that. Whereas before, they either weren't selling anything because they didn't have a publisher or whatever, or they were selling very little with the publishing contracts they did have. And that's the big message. You know, I've been that person doing that now for 3 years. I mean, the last payment I had from my publishers, Simon & Schuster, was November 2013. You know, everything since has been indie. And it works. I've now become an outlier again, so it's not as easy to sort of like blow that horn for people. But yeah, they're the real story. You know, people like me are kind of a little bit unusual, a bit lucky maybe in a lot of respects. But there's so many authors, and of course you don't see them in interviews, you don't see them on the bookshelves. They're not household names. And yet we're all going, yeah, I'm a full-time writer and I'm doing really great, you know. And you see them on the forums more often, not on keyboards and things like that, where you see these names and they're saying, yeah, I've quit my job. You know, I've gone full time as an author. And yet we go to the crime festivals and you find out the authors are going back to their day jobs because they can't make any money out of it anymore. So that is, and that's why the indie game is as good as it is. It's for someone like me to be in a position that I was in, doing so well, to then completely abandon that. It took me 15 years to get into it. I was in it for 2 years and I'm out. You know, because this is better. Yeah, so it says a lot.
Yeah, and also the industry change. So I think I just wanted to ask you about resilience in terms of mindset and kind of keeping going, because that big shift in 2012, as traditional publishing changed, the global financial crisis, you know, there were mergers and acquisitions, and that was a time of instability. We're entering into another period of instability. It certainly feels like it. Like, we're in the UK, we've just triggered Brexit. The American political situation is interesting. You know, the news is full of saber rattling and things. And it feels like things are unstable, and so, you know, one can see that in the publishing industry too. So what is your advice for people in terms of resilience and dealing with change, and how should they go about that?
Well, yeah, sticking with it is the main piece of advice. I mean, there's not much you can do about these changes we're seeing in the world. I mean, Brexit, big fuss over nothing, really. It's fine, we'll be okay. We got through two world wars, so did America, you know. Brexit. People worry about the security situation. The EU has nothing to do with security. That's called NATO. We'll be fine. America, God up your...
Well, this is not a political podcast.
No, it's not. Nothing. What can you say? I mean, it'll be what it is. What it is, I think Americans like to say out there. As far as writing goes, you've just got to stick with it. I like to put some occasional recent political events into my books to give them more realism and give them a grounding in current events. You just have to ride out these storms, especially with digital publishing. It's the fastest changing industry I've ever witnessed. Every year is different, whether it be with Amazon and KU1 and KU2 and things like that. And now, you know, the introduction of VAT into EU sales for books and that. One of the biggest things there is that the consumer, unfortunately, always has to absorb the cost. And it's the same for us as authors. You know, when the VAT was introduced in the EU for digital book sales, we all put our prices up. Mm. I did, you know, I didn't want to, but you have to do it. And we just have to adapt. But that's one of the strengths of indies. You know, we can turn on a dime. Political stuff, as you say, not a political blog. Publishing isn't a political realm either, as a rule. It survives great things, great upheavals all the time. You know, well, writing didn't stop because World War II was on. You know, it still carried on. I would not spend too much time worrying as an author about the greater political or geopolitical situation anyway, because we're authors. We just got to carry ourselves through that and just carry on, and it will settle down. It always does.
And use your anxiety in your writing, I guess. And as you say, if you keep your rights, you have a chance to take advantage of any new position as well. Whereas if you are in traditional publishing, you may get dropped for what I think will be a resurgence in cozy mystery, knitting, romance, and lots of safe and happy things.
Happy stuff. Yeah, happy pictures on the cover. Yeah, you're very much, yeah. It's...
Cozy sci-fi.
Yeah. It's such a difficult thing to have an opinion on, really. It'll be fine. It's the only way you can look at it. It'll be fine. We'll all be okay. I think there's a lot of worry, a genuine worry, and it's understandable as well, but we've been in worse places. I mean, everyone's heard of, I don't know, think of a crisis, Bay of Pigs. Everyone was pointing nuclear missiles at each other. You know, we've been in worse spots before. Don't worry about it. Just keep writing your books and keep it moving forward. And we will come out the other side of it. And, you know, hopefully, well, we're in the digital publishing age. It hasn't even got started yet. You know, we're at the early part of it. It'll ride through and it'll probably get better and it'll move on to other technologies as well, I hope, and we'll expand into other things. So, don't about it too much would be my advice. Keep
awesome
going.
Awesome. So tell everyone where they can find you and your books online.
All my books you can find at deancrawfordbooks.com, and I'm also on Amazon. Very easy, just type my name in. I'm there, I'm everywhere. and I'm exclusive to Amazon as well, so that's the only place I'm on at the moment. Or I may possibly start to expand out from Amazon.
Depending
how nicely.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Dean. That was great.
Thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dean and that it's encouraging you in your own long-term author journey. And next week, I'm talking ebook bundling for authors with Chuck Heintzelman, which is pretty good timing considering my fiction income is so great with box sets. And we also talk about the sticky question of money for author collaborations. And Chuck has designed something that might help, which I'm very excited to be talking to him about. You can also get Chuck's book on ebook bundling for authors in the Story Bundle, which will finish this week. So go check it out at storybundle.com/writing. Plus, I'll tell you about Venice next week. So happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.